Hi, and welcome to the Crime Pod. I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Sam.
And we are back just as a pair. Thank you for letting us try something a bit different last week and having Dawn on from Scottish Murders. I hope you enjoyed our episode, and we've obviously recorded an episode with her, which we will tell you a bit more about later when that's coming out. This week, we are off to England and we're heading back to the 80s, and I'm going to tell you about the disappearance of Susie Lamplugh. Yes, as I said, it's back to the two of us, but to touch on the episode that we done with Dawn, it was actually a Sam case, and it was really, really good. I would argue one of Sam's best, and it wasn't for us.
I'm not even going to be offended. This is probably true.
Honestly, I was like, you're selling something, we're not. Sam's episode will be available, I believe it is the 23rd. Of April, which I think is a Tuesday, I think. However, by the time this episode comes out, we are less than a week to go to CrimeCon. So obviously Sam and I are going to CrimeCon, so we will put a reminder out, but we are not going to be releasing an episode on Sunday the 28th of April. There's just loads of, we're doing CrimeCon basically, and just to make sure everything kind of edits and goes out and records and stuff, we've been doing other things. So we're going to take this week and we'll put a reminder out on the 28th, and that's maybe a good time to keep a hold of that podcast with Dawn to then go and get a listen to on the Sunday, so you're not missing us too much. I understand a Sunday's not the same.
Said no dulcet tone.
And by obviously the time this episode goes out, we are less than a week to CrimeCon, which we are really, really excited about. And we've put quite a lot out on our Instagram this week because we've obviously got some merchandise for us to wear. And I think we're both quite stunned at the amount of people that were like, can I buy this, please? And we were like, why? And it was so weird seeing like our logo on a top. So, watch this space. We'll see what we can do on the merchandise front. But we're hoping to have something with you all soon. Okay, Sam, I feel like it's a silly question asking you if you've heard of Susie Lamplugh.
Well, let's just keep the tradition going because I've obviously not.
You're joking.
Well, like the surname rings a bell, but then so does Susie, and to be honest, no.
Right. Susie Lamplugh is one of those cases. I'm going to. So here.
No, and then I might know about it.
All right, okay, I think we'll go ahead. I was like, imagine, I've heard of it. Okay, end of the episode. Susie Lamplugh is one of those cases that I double checked we hadn't done, because I feel like it's one that, of course, we've done it because it is just such a common case. However, we actually haven't done it. So buckle up, because it is a story. And as much as I feel like you will know the story when I maybe start talking about it, or listeners, you'll all probably have heard of Susie Lamplugh and kind of know the current situation of it. However, there's so many more parts of this story that I actually wasn't aware. So Susie was born Susanna Jane Lamplugh, and she was born on the 3rd of May 1961 to parents Paul and Diana Lamplugh. She had three siblings, Richard, Lizzie and Tamsin. Now, Susanna, well, her name's Susie, I'm going to call her Susie, no, I just read that, Susanna, sorry. She was an estate agent working for an agency called Sturgase, and that was based in Fulham Road in London. Now, I don't know much about the kind of 80s, apart from the music, the fashion, that kind of side of things, but for a more financial point of view, there was a huge property boom at this time. Everyone wanted houses, basically, so estate agents were a very popular job to get in, and on commission alone, estate agents were making thousands and thousands of pounds. Now, Susie mentioned in a diary that she kept how happy she was to actually have gone for the interview and been hired on the spot of the January of 1986. Now, her boss actually placed Susie's desk near the window, and this was basically because she was an absolutely stunning girl. She was beautiful, she was very attractive, and it's the 80s, it's the business world. They're hoping that's going to get people in and get them sales when they see someone like Susie Lamplugh working there. Now, around this time, so we're going to go to about the June, July of 1986, Susie had mentioned to her mum and her uncle that she was experiencing traits from a stalker. things were getting delivered to her, flowers. She just had a bit of a feeling about something, but she wasn't too concerned. She was still going about her day-to-day life, but she had mentioned this to her mum and uncle. On the 28th of July 1986, she went to work like any normal day. It's the end of July, it's London, it's an absolute beautiful day, and Susie goes to work at the estate agents. She has an appointment to show a house in Shorrold Road, Fulham, to a man in her diary known as Mr. Kipper. This house had only been on the market for a week, and I think it was quite a nice house, so that's why she's probably going to go get all this house seen out, even though it's only a week, and get that sold to make herself again some good commission. Her office diary had in it the appointment as, quote, 12:45 Mr. Kipper, 37 Shadows, O/S. O/S means outside the property. By about 3:30 that afternoon, Susie's colleague realised that she hadn't come back from that appointment, and this started to kind of raise some concern in the estate agents. At 4:30, they actually travelled to 37 Charles Road to see if she was there, but she wasn't, and neither was her car. So again, I was like, why did they even bother to go and check? But actually, it could be that this appointment has ran on. It could be that the guy's got there and been like, I'm a multimillionaire and I want to buy it now. Let's get it done. Or it could be that she then went, oh, actually, this house isn't suitable for you, but I'll take you to another house. There could be loads of reasons. But she wasn't there. So at 5:30, the police were called to report her missing by her colleagues at the estate agent. And remember, at this time as well, there is no mobiles to check in. So mobiles weren't even really a thing, so it's not like you can say, well, I'm going to this appointment, I'll have my phone on me, you know, check in. Nowadays, look at the amount of things you could do. Like, you could have your location on and it could ping to, you know, someone in the office to know where you are, to let them know you've arrived at the house. Do you know what I mean? Whereas back then there was no option for something like that.
Well, you had those big ass mobile phones. It's like you ain't gonna fit them in your pocket. But
yeah, do you have a phone on you? No, and the aerial. Yeah, sticking out. That's not a phone. So exactly, yeah. Now, there's quite a lot of witnesses. This is quite a popular road in London. So 3 witnesses saw her outside this house in 37 Charles Road between 1:45 and 1:00. Now, a man walking past the house on his way home saw her at the gateway of the property at 10:01. And it seemed to be that she was waiting for someone. 10 minutes later, the next door neighbour heard someone leaving number 37 and saw Susie and a man leaving the house and actually standing outside and looking back up at the house and talking about the house, which is probably a very normal thing to see when a house is for sale with an estate agent and a potential buyer. This sighting then actually got like a photo fit made of this man, because right now he is the last person to have seen Susie, like, at all with her registered as missing. The sighting of the pair standing outside the house was actually then corroborated by another man who walked past the house at the same time. Now, he noticed that the man that Susie was talking to was actually holding a bottle of champagne with ribbon wrapped around it. And this man was then another photo, like, drawn up of him to be a potential last person that saw her. Now, the champagne around it really got me thinking, because I'm like, okay, why would you turn up to buy a house with a bottle of champagne? Not just even a bottle of champagne, like a bottle of champagne with like ribbons around it. Like, again, this could be a very chill thing that this guy is just coming to money and this is a big celebration for him and he's giving it to Susie to be like, thank you, you've just sold me a house or whatever. No idea. Now, this man was described as a white male, just a button. I don't know if you can hear that banging, but my neighbour has decided to do some DIY while we are recording. So, apologies.
Yeah, I can hear it.
I'm really sorry. No, honestly, no, I'm really sorry. That literally, as we were recording the intro, I heard something and I was like, And then they decided to do DIY. So, I'm really sorry. This breaks everyone's vision that we're in some amazing recording studio. I'm in my house and it's doing DIY next door. I really apologise. If it keeps going, I'll send my partner through. I won't. But anyway, the man is described as a white male between 25 and 30. He had a dark complexion and had dark swept back hair. He was immaculately dressed. He had a dark charcoal suit on and he was described as a, quote, public schoolboy type. He also had a bit of a squint nose, so he may have had a broken nose as well. Now, witnesses reported that they then saw the pair getting into a car, and one of the neighbours has actually said that they thought the pair were arguing before they got in the car. A man had also said he'd seen a, quote, couple arguing between 2:30 and 2:30 in the area that day as well. Now, there was then a sighting of Susie's car driving quite erratically away from Shorrells Road, arguing with a man who was in the passenger seat, causing witnesses to swerve to avoid collision. Now, this was only, I think, one or so sightings. I don't think there was multiple, like saying, like, she, it's not like it was, she was swerving up and down roads in London and roads were going, do you know, having to be closed, whatever. It was just, I think that was only one sighting. She drove a white Ford Fiesta, and this was then seen poorly parked outside a garage opposite Stevenage Road. So that's about a mile away from the house she was shown, and several witnesses at various points in the afternoon saw the car parked there. However, this was said not to be true, as her close friend Barbara Whitfield insisted she had seen Susie driving her car up the Fulham Place Road, Fulham Palace Road, sorry, in her car with a man at about 3:15. So that then doesn't make sense unless there was another white Ford Fiesta parked. But again, the registration. So she had the registration B396GAN. That was the car people said they've seen, and that was Susie's car. Now, this friend said she'd waved to Susie as she cycled down the road, but Susie was actually talking to the passenger, so didn't see her, so didn't wave back. Now, she is the only witness that day who had seen Susie, and the only witness that day who actually knew Susie as well, like, to be away from the house. So this sighting is like a main sighting, to be fair. There was also another woman who lived at 139 Stevenage Road, and she reported that she possibly saw Susie with a smartly dressed man wearing a suit by that where the car was parked outside the garage. So we then have someone who doesn't know her but seeing a man in a suit and Susie a mile down the road with this parked car. At 10 p.m. the officers found Susie's car parked at the same spot in which the witnesses had saw in the afternoon, and this was by another house that was for sale. So it could be, as I'd said earlier, that a point rang on, this guy's going, this isn't my thing, and she goes, oh, actually there's one that's only a mile down the road, jump in the car and I'll go and take you to it. Again, probably not something that we'd do now, like just saying to a random man you're meeting and you only have his surname for, like, sure, yeah, I'll drive you down. But again, it was a different time. It wasn't, these things weren't thought of as much. Now, in the car, her purse was found, but her own keys nor the keys to 37 Shorrells Road were found. They have never been found. The driver's seat was pushed back into a position from which Susie would not have been able to drive the car, indicating that someone else had driven the car because it was too far away for her size to have been able to reach the pedals, let's say. Police suggested that a black left-hand drive BMW vehicle might have been involved, following an eyewitness's account of a car of that description seen parked in Shorrells Road as well. So this is another car they're looking for, and they believe that this belongs to the man. Now, the man who was a witness seeing this car remembered seeing it because many cars on the road had been double parked, causing him some difficulty to drive through the road. Another witness then comes forward and corroborated this account and says that he had also seen a dark coloured BMW parked almost directly outside 37 Shorrells Road. Witness said they'd also seen two white Ford Fiestas parked in Shorrells Road that day. So this could then have been a confusion between Susie's car and another white Ford Fiesta. So this is all a bit of a mess, right? A lot of cars getting involved, a lot of people saying they saw her there, all with this man, but some are saying they looked like they were arguing, some saying they're not looking like they're arguing. So for the police, they're like, this is quite a difficult thing to work on. Now,
Can I just interrupt you?
Uh-huh.
With all these witnesses, it's the same with every case we do, that, oh yeah, that was a number plate, that was the colour of car. I'm always in awe, because I'm like, what? Anything that goes past me and happens, I'm like, hmm?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what? Like, mm-hmm. What colour was that? Was that a car?
I remember watching a programme, and it was a reconstruction of the Jodie Jones murder. Which, if you're like, what's the Jodie Jones murder? Go back, way back to the start. Go back 4 years and you'll find we covered it. But they did. So one of the main witnesses in that case saw Luke and Jodie entering the woods, right? And this person was driving round a corner, like round a bend at about 30, 40 miles per hour. So in this TV show, they reconstructed that and got people to drive around, but didn't tell them what they were looking for. So they got them to drive. And then they asked them, like, what were the couple wearing that were entering the woods? And 90% of them were like, what couple entering the woods? Like, I don't have a clue what they're talking about. And it was really good, because this woman was adamant that she knew it was Luke Mitchell. He was entering the woods with Jodie Jones at this exact time. Blah, blah, blah. She was adamant it was him. And it's like, but I've just driven home. If you'd asked me, like, did this kind of car pass you on your way home? I couldn't fucking tell you. I genuinely couldn't.
No.
Like, do you know what I mean? So Yeah, really, I always find that really interesting that people come forward and notice things like cars or people standing outside and stuff like that. You know, I think you've got to be a very specific type of person to do that. It's not me. Anyway, back to the story. So another witness has offered information after the disappearance, but his account was dismissed at the time because he described a blonde-haired woman. So he says there's a blonde-haired woman outside, right? Susie was blonde. However, the police had incorrectly assumed that she had brown hair when she vanished. She had dyed her hair the week before, and the police hadn't got an updated picture. So they actually also released a missing picture of her with brown hair. And all the claims coming in saying a blonde-haired woman, they're dismissing because they don't realise that she's blonde. How fucking
I'm sorry, did
stupid.
they not check with people first before they put this out?
I know, I know, I know.
Lord.
I know, I know. So another witness, this is me kind of summing up. This is one of my final car witnesses, so don't worry, right? The witness, there was another witness jogging along and he saw a car speeding down Stevenage Road, the same road that our car was found abandoned, as he emerged from Bishop Park into the road near Fulham Stadium. Now the car, which he noticed was a dark-coloured left-hand drive BMW, suddenly stopped further down the road and a woman who matched Susie's appearance was then seen struggling with a man inside and she was sounding the horn in an attempt to attract attention. In this description of the incident, the witness actually said, quote, "I came out of the park to be met by a BMW which tore across the road and came to a halt with somebody in there with their hand on the hooter, pressing it for a very long time. As I stood there, I saw a blonde young lady. She looked as though she was laughing or she could have been screaming. What worried me was how she could drive with what was going on, but it never occurred to me that it was a left-hand drive car," end quote. This man also didn't think he'd get involved and go and maybe, oh, maybe the woman that looks like she's laughing but not and is blasting the horn, I should maybe go and check she's okay. Again, nah, just pass this on to the police once Susie had got Susie, sorry, had gone missing. So anyway, that's us kind of done with our witnesses, and I'm going to move on to the missing person inquiry. So police released a photo, as I said, with dark hair, but she dyed her hair blonde the Friday before she vanished. So this, don't worry, this does get changed, and a blonde photo does go out eventually. The initial investigation was conducted without computers. We're talking about the 80s here, people. So they actually used an old-fashioned card index system. So all leads were filed in approximately roughly 26,000 cards. Because Susie was only considered a missing person, known criminals in the area were also not considered a suspect. Now, Susie had a boyfriend, a 27-year-old stockbroker, and she lived with him and her male flatmate. And they were both questioned by police, but they both had solid alibis with corroborating witnesses, so none of them were looked at. Her two-bedroom flat in Putney was searched, but nothing notable or suspicious was found. And her office manager revealed that a bunch of red roses had been delivered to the office by a mystery man just days before her disappearance. Now, what you're going to notice a lot of this case is it goes cold for periods of time. So we're going to go cold for about 6 months now. So 6 months after the disappearance, a man then informs the police that he had discovered that a BMW that had been left abandoned in the road for some months was registered to a Belgian man known sometimes as Mr. Kipper. Detective believed this information was significant, so they locate this man in Belgium. He confirms he's got an alibi the day of the disappearance. He says his BMW has been in a garage in Belgium on that day. So he's eliminated, and then again, we go cold again. A year after Susie's disappearance, detectives noticed that the artist's impression of Mr. Kipper strongly resembled John Cannon. He was a convicted rapist who had been residing in the nearby prison hostel outside prison Wormwood Scrubs around the time of Susie's disappearance. Now, John Cannon is a man that I'm going to talk about a long, long time now. He's going to be up until the end of this episode. So I'm just going to give you a really quick brief on him because unfortunately I could find more information about his upbringing than I could Susie's, which I say unfortunately, it means that his is more notable. Susie, I think, was a very, very normal girl. So that's why there's not as much. So he was born to his father, Cyril, who was a flight attendant in the Royal Air Force during the Second World War, and his mum, who was a stay-at-home mum, Sheila. And he was born just outside of Birmingham on the 20th of February, 1954. He came from a middle-class family and attended public school until the age of 15, but he was then sent by his parents to a private school for boys, aged 4. He said that when he was there, he was about 7 or 8 years old, a teacher sexually abused him, and this continued for months and months. The events had lasting effects on him. He felt deeply ashamed and he became afraid of school and developed a stammer for being that nervous in a school environment. At age 9, he was removed from the school and took to a doctor for his anxiety. And he claimed that the sexual abuse left him with feelings of humiliation and shame, which turned him to then express them in ways of anger and resentment. In 1968, age 14, he indecently assaulted a woman in a phone box in Erdington, for which he was placed on probation. He married his first wife, June, in May 1978, 7 years after they originally got engaged. That was like his only kind of main relationship, to be fair, but he did claim he was hassled into marrying her. She gave birth to their child, which he didn't want, basically. He was quite open about it, and you know, said John didn't want this child. So he slipped into alcoholism and then kind of left them. To be honest, he just went off. In 1980, he then raped and beat his girlfriend when she tried to leave him, and he raped a shopkeeper at knife point in 1981. John had been on day release from the prison in the months just before Susie's disappearance and held a job in the area as a porter. He was public school educated and well known for his ability to attract women. So you're kind of thinking like, not to that extent, but like a Ted Bundy vibe. In the weeks before Susie's disappearance, John had told inmates and workmates that he was going to wine bars in Fulham and had met a new, quote, uptown girlfriend named Susie. Susie had visited some of the wine bars, including one opposite her office, and John had also frequented a pub in Putney that Susie had visited on the 25th of July 1986, the same day he was released from prison and 3 days before her disappearance. He was known previously to deliver roses to women as a romantic ploy, and he told people he was interested in buying property in the area. It was soon suggested in the press that if Mr. Kipper's first name was Dan, the combination would be an anagram of kidnapper. However, we still don't know what Mr. Kipper's first name was. Spoiler. In June 1987, Susie's mother, Diana, said that she actually believed her daughter was dead and had kind of resigned to that fact, which I think is horrific. I can't imagine what it'd be like to be just kind of assume or confirm that your child is dead. However, I don't know if that is better than thinking she is out there missing somewhere and you don't know where she is. So yeah, that's really difficult. In the years after Susie's disappearance, police tested the DNA of over 800 unidentified bodies and skeletal remains that matched her description. She was officially declared dead at her parents' wishes, basically 7 years after her disappearance on 27th July 1993. She was presumed to have been murdered, but again, and that's a spoiler, no remains have ever been found. So going back to John Cannon for a bit here, why they were connected so much, I think, is because of the misappearance. That's a combination of both a disappearance and the murder of Shirley Banks. So in October 1987, 50 months after Susie disappeared, John Cannon abducted and murdered 29-year-old Shirley Banks from Bristol. He also attempted to rape two women in a shop 3 weeks later, and he drove to the shop in his black BMW. He had also tried to abduct a woman the night before he had abducted Shirley Banks, and he had actually been visiting wine bars in Bristol in the search for victims. Now, Shirley Banks, to be honest, I could do a whole episode on her, but I'm going to really quickly try and sum this up. Shirley was a newly married 29-year-old textiles factory manager from Clifton. She was abducted on the 8th of October 1987, just after 7:40 p.m, while out on a shopping trip to the Broadmead Centre. Her husband searched for her in bars, and when she failed to return home as they had agreed to meet for a drink, he rang her work the next morning and was told she had just phoned in sick with an upset stomach 15 minutes earlier. When she again failed to return home, he called the police. Police believe that Shirley was held overnight in John Cannon's flat and that he had persuaded her to call in sick to work to not raise suspicion. He then pretended he was going to release her, however he didn't, held her in his flat for 18 hours before killing her and dumping her at a site in the Quoctuck Hills, known horrifically as Dead Woman's Ditch. Her naked, moss-covered, decomposed body was found in a stream on the 3rd of April 1988, 6 months after her disappearance. They found her gold jewellery and buttons from a dress that she had bought, and according to pathologist Bernard Knight, she was killed by being hit repeatedly on the head with a rock. Inside his car, when it was searched, the BMW, they found an imitation handgun, handcuffs and the tax disc for Shirley Banks' car. Soon after John Cannon was arrested, her Mini was found hidden in his garage with a new false number plate reading SLP386S. So what they're thinking later on is SLP could stand for Susie Lampoo, and the number 86 is the year that Susie Lampoo went missing.
Like, that screams, I did it, and I'm showing off. You absolutely can't catch me.
Literally. The media began to note likeness between John and the photo fit from Susie's case and speculated about a link between Shirley Banks and Susie Lampoo cases. It was also known that John had joined a dating agency in Bristol weeks before he had murdered Shirley, proving a false name of John Peterson. And he presented himself in a recorded video, as a successfully, smartly dressed businessman. This video is still accessible to public if people would like to go and find it. The Met Police detectives went to Bristol to interview John about the Susie Lampley disappearance. When he was asked by detectives if he understood the significance of the number plate, he replied that it could be seen as a reference to Susie, whom the detectives had not yet mentioned. So they basically said, do you think anything about your number plate? He was like, oh, I understand how you could link it to Susie Lampley. They hadn't mentioned her name. He mentioned it first. John Cannon claimed...
If that just doesn't scream that I did it, I don't know what does.
I know, babes. John claimed that he had chosen those letters for the plate at random. He claimed that he'd bought the car from a Bristol businessman who was responsible for the murders of Shirley Banks, Susie Lamplugh and another girl, and that this man was in a great deal of trouble. John was known for masquerading as a businessman, and when asked if the man was himself, John provided an affirmative response but immediately recanted this and ended the interview because he said he was overcome with emotion. John was sentenced to light imprisonment for the murder of Shirley Banks and for several other rapes, abductions and attempted abductions. He was also convicted of the rape of a woman in Reading on a train line between London and Bristol 6 weeks after his release from Werwood Scrubs prison. The sentencing judge told John, you should never be again at a liberty outside. Blah, I'm going to start that whole thing again. The sentencing judge told John, you should never again be at liberty outside of prison walls. Other interviews that were conducted with John regarding Susie's disappearance in 1988, 1989 and 1990, however, he was never once placed on identity parade and never gave anything enough for them to convict him. In 1990, a woman named Jilly Page, who John had been in a relationship with after Susie's disappearance, informed the police that John had spoken about Susie Lamplugh's disappearance and told her that Lamplugh was buried at Norton Barracks. Another former girlfriend of John, Daphne Sargent, also believed John to be responsible, saying, quote, as soon as I heard about Susie, I knew it was John. It had all the hallmarks, right down to the champagne, end quote. It goes a bit quiet there on the John front, and I'm going to kind of quickly jump to tell you a bit of a story. The only reason I'm kind of jumping is because it happened in 88 and some other stuff move on from it. So I'm just trying to keep you on the timeline. Now, a book was released about Susie Lamplugh's case in 1988 by journalist Andrew Stephen. This book was initially supported by Susie Lamplugh's family, then they read its drafts and it became a highly controversial book. It included several allegations about Susie Lamplugh's sex life and personal life. He suggests that she might have been involved with prostitution, and the book was widely labelled as false and that he was accused of victim blaming. The Met Police actually responded to the book by defending Susie Lamplugh's personal life and stating, quote, our investigations revealed nothing more than Susie was a modern young woman. So this arsehole is trying to bring out a book basically saying that she lived this really promiscuous life, she was a prostitute, and that's what's happened. There's absolutely no evidence. Susie Lamplugh was not
even
a prostitute.
If she was.
Even if she was. That,
she doesn't need to get murdered.
Exactly. Exactly. So, but again, it's a very big lie to make up. Do you know what I mean? Oh, this missing woman. Yeah, she was a prostitute. No, she wasn't.
Yeah, I'm gonna
it's not just saying it. Yeah, it's not just talking in the pub and saying, yeah, she was. You wrote a book about it.
Yeah, that's a bit.
So, there's another couple of people that are seen to potentially be the murderer. And I'm going to kind of, as they come in, I'll tell you a bit about them. But one of the first was Michael Sams. And in the mid-1990s, speculation started arising about him as he had just been convicted of kidnapping an estate agent named Stephanie Slater in Birmingham. Police found no evidence for the theory and basically discounting it, noted that Sam's crimes were likely influenced by the Susie Lamplugh case. Like, instead of actually doing it, that's kind of gave him inspiration on how to kidnap somebody. Sam's also, the main thing that noted is he had one leg and no witnesses saw the man with Susie that said he had a limp or only having one leg. In 1999, an internal report by the Met Police criticised the handling of the original investigation and failure to further investigate John Cannon. So we're swinging back to him again. So a new reinvestigation was launched in early 2000s with a new team whose detectives were directly determined to find out if John Cannon could be eliminated or implicated, basically. The reinvestigation established that John Cannon could not be eliminated and discovered more evidence that implicated him. The paper index cards used, the ones I spoke about way back in the original investigation, were computerised, and investigators learned that several estate agents in Fulham had been visited at the time by a man calling himself Mr. Kipper. Detectives believed that this had been John Cannon seeking potential victims for abduction and murder. Now, this was back in the 1970s, so swinging it back, and 1980s, during the final years of John Cannon's troubled marriage to his wife June, there had been a series of mysterious rapes in homes for sale in the West Midlands, where John was living. This unidentified rapist specifically targeted homes on the market for sale by estate agents and was actually known as the House for Sale Rapist, and they believed this was John Cannon. 20 women were assaulted and raped in properties in the area, and no one was ever arrested or caught for these crimes. Police suspected that John was responsible for the crimes, which began when his marriage was failing, and then these rapes stopped in early 1980 when he began a new relationship with a woman named Sharon Major. Detectives later noted that the offences bore all of the hallmarks to John Cannon's later crimes and noted similarities to the Susie Lamplugh case. He had appeared uninvited at a house for sale in Shorrells Road days before Susie Lamplugh was last seen, believing that a young female occupant was alone in the house. He'd acted strangely until the woman's husband appeared, and then he just quickly left. A new reconstruction was shown on...
I don't know.
Time Watch.
Oh,
I was going to say, I'm going to fucking leave. Yeah. Were you bored?
Doing my dishes, mate.
Right. So she was shown on Crime Watch in 2000, and this included correct pictures of Susie with the blonde hair, and new witnesses start coming forward. Now, a witness included a man who had said they had seen a man resembling John Cannon looking into the window of Susie Lamplugh's estate agency on the day she disappeared. Susie had worked at a desk near the window, as I said, because she was attractive and it would attract customers. Film witnesses also emerged after police showed John Cannon's 1987 dating video, and they identified him positively as the man they'd saw in Fulham that day. So it wasn't just a photo fit. They were like, no, no, that is literally the man who I saw. During this reinvestigation, a mass of circumstantial evidence was uncovered at that point that all pointed to John Cannon. It was discovered that Susie had disclosed to relatives, as I said at the start, that she had a new boyfriend from the Bristol area where John Cannon had moved to after the disappearance, and that's where his family originated. What does confuse me, though, is Susie apparently did have a boyfriend. But in this piece of evidence, in this piece of the story I'm reading, sorry, apparently she then had a new boyfriend. So I'm not 100% sure on the correction of that, but I just wanted to obviously make you aware. Even though John Cannon was in prison before the disappearance, he denied ever being to Fulham. So he had said, I've never been to Fulham, but he was in the prison in the borough of Hammersmith in Fulham. So again, he's just caught himself in a lie. Police disproved this claim, and John Cannon was known to have worked as a porter in the areas at the time when he was on day release from the open prison. Now, the witnesses cite in the dark left-handed drive BMW near Susie, and they'd seen that she'd been struggling in this car. They were, they basically were told like how significant this was, because it emerged that John Cannon owned such a car at the time and had used it to commit crimes with a fellow inmate. John Cannon did not have an alibi for the days after leaving prison and claims not to recall where he was at the time, despite him having an impeccable memory of other events. So you say, okay, you're on day release from prison. Where did you go? Oh, I can't remember. Like, what do you mean? Is that not quite a significant event? Anyway, you'll never guess what I'm about to tell you. John Cannon had a nickname in prison because he wore Kipper-style broad ties. So what did they nickname him? Mr. Kipper. The exact same person that Susie Lamplugh was meeting on the day she disappeared. In December 2000, John Cannon was arrested on suspicion of Susie Lamplugh's abduction and murder and was interviewed at Hammersmith Police Station. Video footage of part of this interview were actually leaked publicly and are still available if you want to go and find them. Now in the footage, John Cannon says that there are one or two things I haven't been caught for. He was interviewed for 5 days, and John didn't provide any interviewers with information that could eliminate him from the inquiry, and he didn't provide an alibi either for his movements between the 25th and 28th of July 1986. In the September of 2001, John was arrested again and questioned at a London police station, but again he provided no information that could eliminate him from the inquiry, but none that could prosecute him either. Investigators believe that Susie Lamplew placed a mysterious phone call during the afternoon in which she disappeared. And 3 days before she disappeared, on the same day in which John Cannon was released from the open prison nearby, Susie had visited the Prince of Wales pub in Putney, which was also frequented by John Cannon. While she was there, the contents of her handbag went missing, and after she left, they were found by the landlord of the pub. The landlord telephoned Susie to inform her, and she arranged to collect her belongings at 6 p.m. on Monday the 28th of July, the day she disappeared. Several hours after Susie vanished, a woman identifying herself as Sarah phoned the pub, saying that she had a message for Susie Lamplew, and she left her number. A man then phoned the pub, claiming to be a policeman, and asked the pub if they had Susie Lamplew's diary and checkbook. The police confirmed the man was not a policeman, and it was actually not ever found out who Sarah was. The landlord said that he gave the paper upon what he'd written the phone number on to the police, although this ended up getting lost and this number was never contacted. The first call was placed well before Susie Lamplew's disappearance had even been reported, and it may have actually been Susie calling, so maybe a plea for help or calling under duress, or maybe John Cannon had asked her to do it. The man identified as a policeman, yeah, he could have been Cannon, because when Shirley Banks was abducted by Cannon and held hostage in his flat, she had to place a call under duress to her workplace the next morning, stating that she was sick. It's believed that she had done this call because John had convinced her that she would be released unharmed if she made the call. This call was the last ever message received, however, from Shirley Banks before she was found murdered. Detectives on the reinvestigation team also believe that John Cannon could have been responsible for taking the contents of her handbag in the pub, and this is a clear indicator of stalking, of course. Now, obviously, all this evidence resurfaces, so again, the police start another search for Susie Lamplew's body. Investigators wanted to dig at the Norton Barracks, where John had allegedly told former girlfriend Jillie Page that the body was buried in 1999. This area had been significantly redeveloped, though, in the last few years, and the army had actually left the site in 79, and the investigators were not able to dig in the area because there was now houses standing there. So unless they had, like, concrete proof she was under there, you can't just dig under people's houses. Detectives considered the possibility that the SLP number plate that John had attached to his car could be an Ordnance Survey grid reference, so the 386 might mean something, as this would provide a location very close to Dead Woman's Ditch, where Shirley Banks was found. John was known to play such tricks with investigators, and it was believed that if his decision to dump Shirley Banks' body in Dead Woman's Ditch was intentional, the letters off the number plate could be as well. It could be that he is really clever and he's basically hiding in plain sight. As a result, investigators searched Dead Woman's Ditch. However, Susie Lamplew's body was not found. In December 2000, the police searched a brickwork near the barracks again that had been mentioned in several of the original witness statements. A year later, another search was conducted in Somerset at a local river that John Cannon was said to have frequented. However, no remains at all were found. The Susie Lamplew case team concluded that there was significant evidence against John Cannon to apply to the prosecution. The Crown Prosecution Service, or the CPS, agreed that the police reinvestigations had been excellent and thorough, but ultimately decided after 4 months of deliberations that there's insufficient evidence to charge John Cannon with Susie Lamplew's murder. The police so strongly felt that John was responsible that they had proclaimed such during a press conference in November 2002. They basically said it outright that he is the murderer, we just can't prosecute him. They also announced that all other possible suspects had been eliminated and he was the only suspect left. The lead detective in the reinvestigation, Jim Dickey, stated that he was as certain as possible without conducting a formal judicial process that John Cannon was responsible. And I'm actually going to read you a quote from him. So this was in 2015, so I know it was a bit early, but he was the senior investigating officer of the reinvestigation team between 2000 and 2006. But here's a quote. Quote, my informed theory is that Susie was stalked by John Cannon. He probably spoke to her, might have even taken her on a date. Susie certainly fitted the profile of what John Cannon sought in that she was blonde, attractive, worked at an estate agent, a very presentable young lady who came from a good family. Little doubt that Cannon stalked her, little doubt that Cannon viewed properties with her, that he observed her through windows of the estate agents, which probably drew him to go in and seek to view properties. I think that Susie got into a row with Cannon on the day. He abducted her from the car or made her get into a vehicle he had at the time. There then ensues probably quite a very heated row where he basically drove off abducting her. Where he went from there is a matter of conjecture. End quote. When interviewed about the disappearance of Susie Lamplugh in 1988, John Cannon had said he knew a Bristol businessman, as we're talking about, who is responsible, but they believe he was actually talking about himself, and they don't just speculate that is what they say he was talking about. Now, remember he said that quote, Sam, that he said that he was responsible for the murder of Shirley Banks, Susie Lamplugh, and another girl. Well, the other girl is believed to be Sandra Court, who was a 27-year-old office worker who was abducted and killed in Bournemouth in May 1986. In November 2001, police interviewed John Cannon at a police station in York regarding Sandra's murder. But he had been in a prison hostel at the Wormwood Scrubs at the time, but he was allowed to leave the facility at weekends and had access to a red Ford Sierra, the same car that was tested in the Susie Lamplugh case.
This man is just...
I know. Oh, there's more. There's more evidence about the Sandra Court murder. So a paying display ticket proves that John was in Bournemouth on the day that she was killed. She had been dropped off by a taxi driver in Throop, Dorset, near her sister's house after a night out, but her sister wasn't home, so she was last seen walking barefoot, appearing slightly drunk at 2:45 in the morning. Her body was found the next day in a water-filled ditch several miles away. Now, when interviewed, John denied ever being in Bournemouth on the day in question, but he was then provided to be lying because of the parking ticket discovered by police. When the Ford Sierra was discovered at a North London scrapyard during the Susie Lamplugh reinvestigation in early 2000, two hairs were found inside that matched Court's DNA, so it matched Sandra Court. However, DNA evidence was not strong enough to bring prosecution against John Cannon for her murder. In 2000,
to circumstantial evidence being allowed?
I know. In 2007, a criminologist who had corresponded with John Cannon revealed that the police reinvestigations of 2000-2002 had discovered DNA evidence in the car previously owned by John Cannon that showed that Susie Lamplugh had been inside his vehicle. The criminologist informed police that John Cannon had access to a red Ford Sierra at the time when Susie Lamplugh disappeared, the same one I've just told you about with Sandra Court, and that his DNA to prove that Susie Lamplugh was in that car. Detectives attempted to find the car and discovered it in the scrapyard, and they did all their DNA analysis on it. Although the test indicated that both Lamplugh and John Cannon had been in the car, the CPS felt there was insufficient evidence to prove that both had been in the vehicle at the same time, meaning charges could not be brought against John Cannon. Although he previously said he drove the car often, John Cannon then changed his story and now denies ever using the vehicle. But the man who'd lent it to him confirmed that John Cannon did have access to this car and said that he may have used it on the day Susie Lamplugh disappeared, which is why the BMW didn't really then hold up much account. Now, in 1982, Susie Lamplugh had worked as a beautician on the ocean liner Queen Elizabeth II. Now, at the same time, Steve Wright, who was convicted in February 2008 of the murder of five women in Ipswich, was also working as a steward on the Queen Elizabeth II. Do you know who he is, Sam?
I think, have we done an episode on him?
He is a Suffolk Strangler.
Yeah, that was me. Woohoo! Well, not the Strangler, I mean the episode. He was an arsehole.
Yes, well, he worked with her on the ocean liner. So in 2008, the Met Police investigated whether Steve Wright was connected with Susie Lamplugh's disappearance, but it wasn't a strong enough line of inquiry, and the senior police officer described the link as speculative. Police investigated the work on the liner for Steve Wright's case, and the records found that he was working on the ship the day that Susie Lamplugh disappeared, meaning he couldn't have been responsible. In August 2010, police began searching a field of the B4084 between Pershore and Drake's, about 3 miles from the former Norton Barracks in Worcestershire, yep, where detectives had wanted to search in 2000 but didn't. Investigators also returned to Norton Barracks and subjected it to a limited search, but again, no remains were found. In December 2002, one of John Cannon's fellow prisoners told the police that John Cannon had said that he had buried Susie Lamplugh under the patio of his mother's house in West Midlands. In late October 2018, police searched the house. They dismantled the garage. They removed its concrete floor while searching the back garden. And on the 12th of November 2018, police announced the search yielded no evidence. In July 2019, a police search of land in Pershore with the assistance of archaeologists produced no relevant evidence. And in August 2019, the specialist investigation team, the SIT, was informed of the sighting of a man resembling John Canning dumping a suitcase in the Grand Union Canal on the day of Susie Lamplugh's disappearance. However, this section of the canal was previously searched in September 2014 for an unrelated inquiry, and nothing was found. The canal sighting was also covered in a documentary, The Vanishing of Susie Lamplugh. John Cannon remains the prime and only subject of Susie Lamplugh's disappearance, and he has falsely claimed that the Metropolitan Police have eliminated him as a suspect. They haven't. He is still the only one. He protests his innocence not only of the involvement in Susie's disappearance, but of nearly all other crimes in which he's been convicted for, including those that were actually proven with DNA links and fingerprint evidence. This includes the rape of the woman in Reading, which forensic evidence linked them, and said that the chances of the perpetrator being anyone other than John Cannon was 260 million to one. While in prison, John Cannon told a solicitor that he might as well, quote, reveal all, unquote, about Susie Lamplugh when his mother died. However, in 2020, his brother revealed that his sister had already unsuccessfully begged him to reveal the location of Susie Lamplugh's body. And the brother insists that he will, quote, take his secrets to his grave because he doesn't have a modicum of regret, conscience or compassion. He is a power freak, end quote. Criminologist Christopher Berry D, who exchanged hundreds of letters with John Cannon while writing a book on him, had also said that John Cannon will not reveal where he deposited the body, as John Cannon is a control freak. Fellow criminologist David Wilson has agreed and said that John Cannon will never confess because he's actually a psychopath. He was eligible for parole in 2022. However, nothing's ever come out from that. And actually, I just went to a talk about, it was the law, I think, is it Heather's Law? Helen's Law. Helen's Law is what they have in England, that basically if someone is convicted of something, they cannot be released on parole unless they say where the body is, if they're still gatekeeping where the body is. And I thought, oh my God, this would be amazing. But actually, he has never been charged with anything to do with Susie Lamplugh. No charges ever been brought against him, and her body has still never been found. The Susie Lamplugh Trust, which is a charitable foundation established in December 1986 by her parents Paul and Diane, is still going now, and the mission of the Trust is to raise awareness of personal safety through training and various projects to help people avoid aggression and to offer counselling and support to relatives and friends of missing people. The Trust also runs the UK's National Stalking Helpline. Paul and Diana Lamplugh were appointed OBEs in 1992 and 2005, respectively, for their charitable work with Susie Lamplugh Trust. Diane died in 2011 at the age of 75, and Paul died at the age of 87 in June 2018. Rachel Griffin, the CEO of the Trust, died of cancer in August 2019. Susie Lamplugh and her family members were all members of the All Saints Church in East Sheen in the London borough of Richmond-upon-Thames, and she is actually commemorated there in a stained glass window that was installed in 1996. What's left of her family or siblings are still trying to find justice for Susie Lamplugh, trying to find her body, but this case is as cold gets. Everyone knows who done it. It was John Cannon. It's so, so obvious he done it, but for some reason, no charges have ever been brought, and he has never to this day said where her body is. So that is the disappearance of Susie Lamplugh that you didn't know anything about.
I didn't, and I still, now I do, obviously.
I thought you were going to say I still don't.
Yeah, no, I was about to, and I was like, no, that's not true. That was awful, obviously, but the amount of life that guy has, like, ruined as well, and gotten scot-free. Yeah, he spent his life in prison after getting caught for something else, but what happened to, like, oh, there's one wee bit of evidence here, and then all this other circumstantial evidence, you're still going to trial and the jury can find you guilty? Like, why has that not been done?
Well, that's what I was thinking, because I was like, surely you could just put charges on him, let it go to trial, and if he's found innocent, he's found innocent. But I don't know if it's now the problem of too many people know the story. How are you going to get a fair jury?
Yeah, that's...
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's one of those of, like currently right now, they're trying to pick the jury for Donald Trump's case. How the hell are you going to do that?
Oh, God, no.
Like, sorry. That is virgin on impossible. Do you know, and it's the same as, like, the O.J. Simpson case. Everybody in the country knows about it, and it's the same with this. If you asked anybody, not you, obviously, as you know, fuck all, but if you asked anybody who murdered Susie Lamplugh, they're going to say John Cannon. Before I started my research, I knew it was John Cannon, and I actually was so shocked that he hadn't been convicted or anything, because I actually thought he had. But everybody knows it's him, so I think if this went to trial, his defence would be straight on the, well, everyone's just assuming it's him already before he's been caught. So I think it's one of those that he is going to die in prison, and I honestly don't believe her body will ever be found, especially if it's been so long, it'll be horrifically decomposed, or if it's in water, it won't be recognisable at all, which is horrific.